What do you think makes a perfect fool's act?
For me, a perfect fool's act is one in which I am completely gobsmacked. I mean, a perfect fool's act is one in which I go, I don't have a clue. Which I feel, I mean, deeply and totally amazed. There are some acts that don't that sometimes win on our show because we don't have details about their methods, but that don't quite give me that feeling. But what I'm in quest of is the feeling that what I'm looking at, boy, I don't have a clue. I mean, it's just that impulse that got you into magic at the beginning, which is being fooled and going, you know, that's what I'm looking for.
This might be like picking a favorite child, but are there some standout performances that you've seen on the show? Can you pick a couple and explain why they resonated with you?
Sure. Let me think. I've seen, there's so many acts. I mean, there's one act on this year that I won't tell you whether she fooled us or not, but I will tell you it is the greatest quick change act you've ever seen in your life, and it's an absolute miracle. I mean, you are watching what you always dreamed quick change would look like, and your jaw is on your chest all the time. When Helen Coughlin first came on the show, Helen Coughlin is an Australian, straightforward, you know, Aussie kind of, here you are, boys, can you figure out my trick? I absolutely love her all the time whenever she comes on. I've only figured out one thing that she ever brought us. She and her 90-something-year-old father come up with these extremely clever things, and her presentation is so sort of forthright. I loved being fooled by John Lovick, Handsome Jack, because he completely and utterly did a sucker gag on me. He did a torn and restored paper in a way that looked exactly like the Chinese laundry ticket that, you know, that I had bought when I was 6 years old. And, you know, and he finishes it up, and then he just handed it to me and walked away. You know, there was a great joy in being that thoroughly suckered. Let me think. Paul Gertner is quite wonderful, and Paul Gertner also does all of those levels of subtle that allow, you know, a magician to go, oh, that's what he must be doing. Uh-oh, I don't have it now. You know, so that's fun. I love the number. I mean, pretty nearly every woman magician that we've had on the show has been very good, which is no surprise because as with doctors, for years and years, magic was just a men's club. And so for a woman to have the stamina to withstand all of the prejudice that women have had to withstand in magic, I mean, that's already a great credit to the person's character. But lately, we've been seeing women who have been extraordinarily inventive and creative and personal, so that they're not really just repeating the kinds of things that men have done for years. You know, there's the style of female magician who will come out, you know, in a tailcoat and do card fans. That's okay, but that's not really bringing a woman's perspective into it. And particularly this year, again, you will see on the show some amazing women, some women who've just said, wait a minute, I'm a woman. I have things to work with that men don't have to work with.
Sure. Vanishing Inc's co-founders, Andy Gladwin and Josh Jay, have both appeared on Fool Us and said the experience was amazing. I've interviewed many magicians on this show who have agreed with them. How did you set up the production side of things so you would make the magicians appearing on the show feel so comfortable?
Well, I can't take a lot of credit for that. For the first few years of the show, that was a lot of what made that work was the combination of Johnny Thompson. I was originally just Johnny Thompson, and then for a while, Johnny Thompson and Mike Close. And now Johnny died, and Mike has taken over. Mike was the key person this last season. We want everyone who comes on to come off magnificently. So the magicians arrive and are warmly welcomed, and then are given time to rehearse on stage, very often longer than we get to rehearse on stage, with the assistance of somebody like Mike Close, who has a great sense of humor, and he not only knows, well, the trick will be more deceptive if you do this. Mike also will say, you need a joke here, and know to add that. So when magicians arrive, they're supported immediately. They're supported mm-hmm. and encouraged by the people we have here, because everyone wants them to look good. I mean, I believe everyone in the entire crew wants them to fool us. They that's their the aspiration of everybody. I mean, kind of including us, is we really want people to come on and fool us. So there's this tremendous sense of support. Then, we really truly don't know who's going to be on the show ever. It's kept. We're kept in a completely separate location. Sometimes people will even be in town who are good friends of ours, and they won't tell us they're in town because it would give away the fact that that's what's going on. They're kept in a completely separate location from us. And then when they come out, there is a moment before the cameras roll where basically Penn and I both go, hi, thank you so much for coming, and really let them know that they're honored guests, and we're rooting for them. And then, I think that kind of accounts for most of it. That we're treating them well. We're treating them as we would like to be treated.
Yeah, back to the thing you said about television not being a good example. You making it a good example.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess I should mention how great Joshua was on the show. Just great.
I've never heard of him, really. Where did the idea of you and Penn standing outside chatting to everybody after a show come from? And aren't you drained after a performance?
Well, I mean, it's something that I'm afraid won't last for very will not resume for some time. It began. I mean, we've always been in the midst of the crowd. We've never been people who, separated ourselves off with a velvet rope from the people who come to see the show. We don't, after a show, we don't hop into the limousine and fly away. When we first worked, the very first gigs that we got were street performance. You can't get away from the crowd there. They're part of the show. They are part of you. Then when we played small theaters, one of the first small theaters that we played, there was no stage door, right? You couldn't get out from backstage without walking right through the auditorium. So we started to end the shows by walking through the auditorium, just hanging out in the lobby. Now, why a performer would not do that is amazing to me. I guess I can understand. If I'm Mick Jagger, and I have 15,000 people in my in a stadium, or 100,000 people in a stadium, I'm not going to have time, and I'm probably going to be treated somewhat roughly by people who have sort of idolized me from afar. We've never been that successful. If you're that successful, I can understand being a little more distant. But when you've only got an auditorium that's got, in our case, like 1,500 seats in it, if you're willing to hang out outside the theater for what is usually a half hour or 45 minutes, the amount of fun that is really hard to exaggerate. I'm meeting people from all over the world. B, I'm meeting people who have come to see the show, sometimes spending a lot more money than they'd spend on anything else. They really, really are happy to be there. C, I have... There's generations of people now. We've been in business for so long. There's generations of people who come to the show. So I think the perfect moment for me was the moment when a guy came up to me and said, I want to tell you, when I was 7 years old, And I was on stage. I was the kid on stage with Mofo the Psychic Gorilla. I still remember that. And I'd like to introduce you to my 7-year-old son.
Oh.
So why wouldn't you do that, you know, if you could? But, you know, now we when the pandemic first hit and we got word of it, you know, people said, well, just don't shake hands and touch your face. Wash your hands before that. So we meticulously did that. But there was about a week of shows when the contagion was really spreading, when we were at risk and just didn't know it. Fortunately, at the end of the shooting of Fool Us, I mean, it's just fortunate that, you know, that we had scheduled Fool Us in such a way that it just skirted disaster. No one involved in Fool Us came down with any symptoms of anything. It's pure sheer luck.
After many years without publishing material for other magicians, what made you want to tackle something like Masterclass?
I was a school teacher for 6 years before I went into this line of work. And when you've been around for a while, sometimes you have stuff that's worthwhile to say. My own instinct is, while I'm doing material, that's not material that I want to publish yet. And, you know, certainly I think I would be remiss if sometime before I'm dead, we don't publish material that we are no longer using. And, you know, I mean, if we're, so the disinclination to publish material is just that, when you publish it, you're inviting other people to do it. And there are things that I would rather keep exclusive for now. Masterclass was an opportunity to take all of that experience that we'd had and talk about the things that we'd learned in interesting ways. It was a great deal of fun, and the Masterclass organization really knows its way around that format, and they made it look very elegant. We shot the entire, you know, course in 3 or 4 days, long days. But then they took it away and they came back and they organized it beautifully. You know, they took things that were by themselves not very satisfactory, but put in context, very useful. We can take credit for the knowledge, but they should take credit for the artfulness of that. And, you know, it was also, as it turns out, Johnny Thompson's last TV appearance. And it's wonderful. It's just wonderful that he was part of that.
For sure. For sure. Talking of mastery, can you talk a little about the T.S. Eliot quote that you like about every venture is a new beginning, a raid on the articulate?
Right on the inarticulate.
Sorry, inarticulate.
With shabby equipment, always deteriorating. You know, it's true that if you're going to do something new, you're always starting from zero. Now, that's not always the case. Sometimes, you know, especially if we have to produce a lot of material, we will adapt something. You know, we will find a way of adapting an existing trick with a new idea. But I'm always resentful of magicians who say, oh, there are no new ideas in magic. It's all, you know, they usually say it's all old wine in new bottles, but I would rather say it's all new wine in old bottles, as though they're just repackaging some lightweight idea in a way that looks very classy. But, I resent people who say everything is just the same as the past. You've just got to do it again and again. And so I'm drawn to that T.S. Eliot quote in which he complains that after all the years he's spent writing, every time he starts writing, it's starting with a blank page and he has to come at it again and he has to go through the same process again. things don't get easier, really. You do get a little smarter about your choices, and you do learn a bit of process. I mean, I'll give you an example. I think when I was 20, I believe that I would, if I wanted to build a box trick, I would design it, build it, and it wouldn't work. And I'd be surprised and disappointed. Nowadays, if I wanted to build a box trick, I would get the idea for it, I'd whack together something in cardboard and see if anything about it could possibly work. If that was encouraging, we'd do another version in plywood and modify it down and do it step by step by step by step. Nothing that you think of ever comes out the way you envisioned it. You've got to test every little thing step by step by step by step. I'm doing that right now with one of the new things that we're creating. Last night, I was over at Tom Rubino's house. Tom Rubino is a brilliant magic builder in Las Vegas. Just brilliant. He's built several things for us before, and he's built things for Carbonaro and Matt Franco. He's built for a lot of people, and he really knows what he's doing. But he knows, just like I know, that you've got to go step by step by step. So last night, I spent an hour and a half in his kitchen, because his workshop was too hot because we're in the middle of a desert, in his kitchen. And he had his little saber saw and he had his measuring tapes and stuff. And we modified this and tried this and modified this and tried this for one beat in a big routine. That's the one thing I can say that you've got to understand if you're creating actual new stuff. It is going to take time. It's just the first idea that you get will not work. And that's just fine, because once you spend enough time with it, you will get better and better and better ideas. Part of what happens when, part of what is called practice. Practice isn't just repeating the same thing over and over again. That's stupid. That's pointless. Practice is doing something again and again and again, and each time getting better ideas and applying those better ideas one after the other after the other. Very frequently when I'm sitting in my TV room, I will have a deck of cards with me because I'm still not happy with the way I control a card to the top of a deck. So I keep experimenting with, would this look more natural? Would this look more natural? Does this fit me? Is this comfortable for me? So that's when T.S. Eliot says that, I fully understand that, but I don't think of it as a negative. I think of it as you just need to know when you're starting on a new bit, the magnitude of what it is you're trying to do. And you also don't want to stop the first time you perform it. Johnny said to us, and I will never forget this, most magicians stop thinking too soon. You need to get it out in front of an audience. You need to work with it. You need to say, oh yeah, this would be so much better if I did this. And then you need to take it back and start again, and until you get to what you're trying to do, because we are in an extraordinarily difficult form. What we are doing must look perfectly impossible, absolutely perfectly impossible. That's a very, very high demand. I mean, it's magic is this sort of off-on switch. Either it's magic or it's crap. And, it's ludicrous crap, too. So it is really, really important to just keep continually improving it, because it's such a difficult art form.
For those of us not lucky enough to have had a Johnny Thompson in our life to sit out the front and say, no, you should have done it like this and do it like that, what are some ways that people listening to this can go down that journey of improvement if they're just kind of on their own?
I think by not being on their own. I mean, I think you need, magic is a social form. That you can't do magic in a vacuum. Maybe a violinist can play a beautiful piece of music for himself and get a certain satisfaction out of that. Magic is not that way. Magic is a communication. It's much like comedy, in that it doesn't exist. Comedy doesn't exist unless there's an audience there to get the joke and laugh. So I think that one essential thing that magicians should do is utilize other people in partnership to watch what they're doing, There's so many levels at which people can be helpful. It's helpful just to have someone volunteer to watch what you're doing. It's helpful to have somebody who is skillful watching what you're doing and saying, you might try, have you thought about it this way? I say this, this is very much in the forefront of my mind, not only because Penn and I do this with each other all the time, constantly, and it's one of the reasons that we've been able to produce as much material as we have, but because the other night, I had done a little talk for Tannen's Magic Camp, and Matt Franco, a fellow magician in town, a wonderful performer, had been on the program also, and he wrote me a little complimentary email and said, if I can ever be of use to you, let me know. And there was a problem that I was stuck on for a piece that Penn and I are working on, and I was just stuck on it. You know, the way sometimes you just can't break loose. You go around in a circle and around in a circle and around in a circle. And I wrote back to Matt, want to Zoom right now? And he went, okay. And he Zoomed. And I told him what the situation was. And we talked. And part of the answer came out of the fact that I have a bin of socks just around the corner there. And part of the answer came from Matt saying, you could end it with this. And suddenly it broke the logjam. And I said, Matt, do you have anything you're working on right now? And he said, well, actually, yeah, I got this routine that I'm working on. Do you have time to look at it? I said, sure. So I watched that. And afterwards, we talked about it. And I think maybe we were able to do a little bit of a breakthrough to unstick him on the problem that he was dealing with. So I think appealing to other people and, you know, not being so damned terrified. You know, magicians are just... They often are terrified. They're terrified of getting caught. Well, I'm afraid that part of getting good is getting caught. So, you know, perform whatever it is that you're working on for somebody, whether they're an audience that's skilled or whether there's an audience that's unskilled, the conversation will help advance the art.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about lying without talking? I understood you first realized the power of this back in your college days with doing the razor blade swallowing.
It's a very interesting thing. I was a strong rebel against patter because I thought most of the time patter was awfully redundant. You know, here I have a ball, I'm putting it into my hand, and now it's gone. I mean, that's just flat. Why would you ever say those words? And yet a lot of people did. And I really just thought as an experiment, can I get the audience to tell themselves the story that I want them to tell themselves by putting evidence out here and letting them add this to that and come to a conclusion, which is, in our case, what we desire is a false but artistically beautiful conclusion. So that it started as that experiment. And as I did it, I discovered a kind of an extraordinary quality that not talking has. And that is, when you stop talking, people are forced to think and look and study what's going on. There is a level of intimacy that you get that you don't have when there are words between you. If I stop right now, suddenly the whole temperature of the room changes. It becomes intimate. It becomes really powerfully intimate. I noticed this very dramatically when I broke that rule when I was first working on the red ball trick. Because that kind of trick had always been done to music. The musician that works with us, Mike Jones, wrote a great little composition to go with my routine. And the routine was not really hitting very well. And one night he had to have some emergency surgery. And I thought, well, I'll just do it to track. And then I tried doing that, and that was terrible. And I thought, let's just try doing it dead silent. And at that moment, the moment that the ball hit the floor, you could hear it. The moment that there was the slightest rustle of reaction from the audience, I could hear that. The conversation had resumed where the musical patter had been in the way. So I'm very interested in that in that experience. And you'll see that it, you know, it weaves in and out. You don't want an entire show done that way, I don't think. I mean, I could conceive of it kind of working, but there is a great important place for speech, but it's got to be speech as interesting as the speech that Penn does. You know, if you don't have that, if you don't have that interest in that kind of language, maybe you should try not speaking. It might not work for you. It happened to work for me because something about the way I think, it's almost as if the audience can read my mind. I never act. I never really make faces. I never do, you know, that sort of clown stuff. I just think the thoughts that I would think if the thing were really happening. And somehow or other, the audience seems to be able to read that on my body. And it's very, it's a weird experience. It's almost, you know, if I believed in that sort of thing, it seems almost telepathic in that they are really reading what I'm thinking. But I know they're reading what they're seeing.
For sure. We're nearly out of time. I just wanted to say, ask you really whether you've enjoyed this forced time off that we've all had at the moment. Has it been a welcome breather for you, or are you just antsy to get back to performing?
I miss performing very much. I have to say, but I'm also not somebody who spends a lot of time wailing over what he can't have. That doesn't seem to me very efficient. So I'm trying to do what I can to continue to exercise the artistic impulses that make me me, without the nightly presence of an audience for however long this is going to be. You know, I think that we're talking about a year or a year and a half. I'm 72 years old. A year and a half is this much time in the course of that. I can learn to live with that, and I can learn to take advantage of that.
So what are you doing to scratch those artistic itches?
Well, primarily working on new material. I mean, that's right. that is what we're doing. I'm also, I've been making the beginnings of write-ups of some of the Penn and Teller material with the intention that by the time I'm ready to publish, I will have accumulated all of that stuff. Because I really would, I'd like not to pass out of this world without leaving some good gifts for people who are also in the art form. I mean, I when I think about how much I learned from, the great Robert Harbin book, which I bought when it came out. And now Harbin is gone, but still, if you really want to understand the zigzag, you don't watch people do it on TV. Read what Robert Harbin has to say about it, because you will really understand if you take advantage of the gift he left us. You will really understand why that trick is incredibly beautiful and powerful, and you won't get that out of some magician who puts it on wheels and dances around with it on stage and does it as a quick flash effect, because it's not that kind of piece of magic. It's a very deep fooler.
You've just excited every single person listening to this show with the talk of that book. Could you tell us anything more about where it's at, what your thoughts are?
Where it's at is I'm halfway through the first draft of a chapter on the needle trick. I have probably 5 pages of notes on shadows. That's about where it is. It's this, you know, this long-term project that I have told myself, if you ever get time off, you'll do. It's very hard to do. I mean, writing is one of the loneliest, hardest things you can possibly do. I'm hoping that, I mean, depending on how long the pandemic goes, we'll see how much of that gets done now.
Well, that's a very exciting bombshell to end the show on. Teller, thank you so much for giving us so much of your time this afternoon. I really, really appreciate it.
You know, I do a lot of interviews here and there, and this is one of the nicest I've ever done because your questions are not the obvious ones, and they're thoughtful and deep and worthwhile.
Thank you.
Thank you.